I'm up on the tight wire.
I'm back in Studio B, sitting across from my good friend Benjamin Alida Sines.
And I'm sitting across from my good friend Daniel Chacon.
And we have a great show for you today on Words on a Wire. We have as our guest poet, an edgy poet, they call her, Kim Adonizio.
And a wonderful interview, I'm sure she'll be.
And on Poetic License today, we have our own Blake Nemec. Blake Nemec is a graduate student at the University of Texas, El Paso in the MFA program.
Thank you.
You're here
in the studio, which means
you have to sit through the whole show before we get to your Poetic License.
I have a visual with the audio. That's exciting.
And what exactly is your theme?
My theme is on workers, borders, trees.
Sounds a little subversive and leftist, Blake. I think we should censor it first.
I'm a log cabin Republican.
Well, we're glad to have Blake, and we're glad to have Kim Adonizio.
And who will also be reading the poem of the week.
Absolutely. And I remember I taught her book, Tell Me, in a poetry class one time, and the students loved it. It's a really great book. But we're going to be focusing on her new book today, which is Lucifer at the Starlight. So one of the things that we always want to remind ourselves, what makes Words on a Wire different, we hope, is that we interview writers as writers. We don't really, we're not journalists per se. I've never even taken a journalism class or never had any ambitions to be a journalist. We're just writers talking about books.
That's right.
So as writers, I want to ask you, Ben, what are you working on these days?
I started a new novel. I've been writing a series of young adult novels, so I'm returning now to an adult novel. It does not have a title.
That's unusual for you. Don't you usually have your titles before you even start writing?
Sometimes. Not always. Not in this case, certainly. And it's really about three men whose lives intersect, and they're all different ages. One of them is 50. One of them is 38. And one of them is like 27. And they're all going through real serious. And the novel, each section of their lives begins in a moment of crisis.
Your last adult novel was He Forgot
Names on a Map.
Names on a Map.
But my collection of short stories is for adults.
Right,
Everything
right.
begins and ends at the Kentucky Club.
Which we're going to talk about on a future show. I think two shows from now, we're going to just sit you down and talk all about that once I finish reading that book. Because I like to read books before we talk to the writers. I mean, it would be kind of weird to ask them questions and not having read the book, right?
It sure would be.
Let's have Ben ask me what I'm working on.
Chacon, what are you working on?
None of your business. No, I'm working on, you know what? I think last night.
You sang to the monster.
No. See, you had to promote another novel, Ben. Would you stop it? Give other people a chance.
Okay. Sorry.
No, actually, that is a good novel. Last night, I sang to the monster, which is another one of Ben's novels. And, you know, every time I think of that, I can't help but sing it to the tune of, I think it's a Madonna song. And I go, last night I sang to the monster.
Aye.
Anyway, I think I started a novel last night. And it's something that I think that's been incubating within me ever since I was 7 years old.
And do you have a title?
No, I don't even know if I have a novel yet. I'll let you know in a couple of weeks because I'll start working on it. But no, I don't have a
title. Do we have a first sentence?
Yes, we do.
Might we hear it?
I don't have it on me. But I know it's a really good first sentence.
A likely story. I bet it is.
No, actually, I think I do have a title. I don't know if this is going to be it, but the working title is Zen Boy and the Yellow Dog.
Nice.
We'll see.
I like it. I think that works.
We'll see. It's going to be a YA novel. I've never written one. Well, I've written a failed one that is still in my computer that I might return to someday. But this will be my first attempt. And I am so inspired by your YA novels, especially that last one, the Aristotle and Dante novel, which is doing very, very well. So you can't help sitting next to you being a little bit influenced by you.
Well, welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Stay tuned for Kim Adonizio.
Kim Adonizio has been called one of our nation's most provocative and edgy poets. Her latest books are Lucifer at the Starlight, a finalist for the Poets Prize and the Northern California Book Award, and Ordinary Genius, a guide for the poet within, both from W.W. Norton. Her novel in verse, Jimmy and Rita, was recently reissued by Austin State University Press. Kalima Press published her Selected Poems in Arabic. Adonisio's many honors include a Guggenheim, two NEA fellowships, and Pushcart Prizes for both poetry and the essay. Her collection, Tell Me, was a National Book Award finalist. Other books include two novels from Simon & Schuster, Little Beauties and My Dreams Out in the Street. Adonisio offers private workshops in Oakland, California and online, and often incorporates her love of blues harmonica into her reading. Sounds very interesting. Kim, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Fantastic.
Okay, let's start by talking about Lucifer at the Starlight. It seems to have a lot of themes in your first book, or your first books, I should say, especially Tell Me, which I thought, by the way, was a fantastic book, and I taught it in one of my my poetry classes. It seems to have more of a reach. It seems to have more of an ambition to go beyond the smoky barroom or the relationship. It seems to go a little bit omniscient and global. Is that a fair thing to say about this book?
Yeah, I think that concern has kind of been there from the beginning through all my books. Tell Me, my third book. You know, I think that's a thread that's been there all along, really. But I think I was looking for new ways to write as well. You know, just to sort of broaden my own aesthetic and my own ability to go places. You know, I found I could write a certain kind of poem, and once I could do it, I wanted to do something else.
Yeah, maybe that's a better way of stating it, because you're right, that reach has always been there. But in this one, I just find that some of the poems are, I'm really into this omniscient voice that you're doing, like, for example, in the tsunami poem. Is this something that comes easy for you?
I don't know. You know, poems just, sometimes they're easier and sometimes they're harder. And it's, you know, it's hard to know. Whatever comes in is sort of what what I'm thinking about at the time. And I don't know, really. It's hard to answer that question, really, of whether it comes easily or not. I mean, poetry is always a challenging art.
Because you teach as well, don't you?
Mm-hmm. I mostly teach privately. I have an online poetry workshop that I do on the internet, and I do a couple classes in my house in Oakland. This fall, I'll be the visiting writer at San Jose State. But mostly I don't teach in the university. I teach privately.
You know, that's one of the things that I've admired about your career, you know, from a distance, is how you really don't have to take the job, you know, that you could make a living off your writing in a sense. Yeah, it's supplementing it here and there. I think that's like the writer's dream. Do you sometimes just think about, oh my gosh, how lucky you are, how wonderful your career seems to be going?
I think about how lucky I am every day in every way. Yeah, I'm incredibly lucky to do this, and it took me a long time to do it, and I sacrificed a certain amount of economic, both money and security.
Right.
You know, I've been paying my health insurance just about my entire life on my own. Right. So there's definitely been sort of economic choices that I made, and I made the choice not to try to teach in a university and become a tenured professor. And I chose deliberately not to go that route because I wanted to write more than anything, and I was really afraid that if I got into a university system, I would find myself with no time to write and spend all my time trying to deal with, you know, academic things and committees and the kinds of things that other people that I knew were dealing with as writers in the university. So I just said, I need to be an artist. And not that people teaching in universities are not artists.
Oh, you know,
by any means.
Yeah, but we do have a lot of stuff to do that takes us away from our writing, that's for sure.
Yeah, so that was my first priority. That was just always my first thing, was that I had to write. And I'm very lucky that it has worked out, that I'm able to have the time to really devote to my writing. And then I also teach, and I love teaching, and I devote a lot of time to my teaching, too. But I'm just really fortunate that I was able to do that. And if not, I think I would probably be, right now, I would either be teaching English overseas or being a fine dining waitress. I think those are the two things that might give me time or feed my writing in other ways.
Are you working on any fiction projects right now, Kim?
Fiction, yeah. I'm finishing a collection of stories, short stories, actually.
Oh.
It's a collection I had put together originally when I first went out to publish my first novel. You know, I was also trying to sell this story collection with it, and a couple of publishers wanted the novel and the stories. But Simon & Schuster, which ended up publishing the novel, did not want the stories. Mm. So that book was sort of abandoned. And I think with good reason. When I went back to it, I realized it wasn't strong enough. And then last year, I was on a writing fellowship, and I thought I was going to be writing poems, and instead I started writing stories again. So I've sort of taken that old collection and, you know, cut out the stuff that didn't feel very good mm-hmm. or interesting and have been writing new stories. So that's been really fun to go back to writing stories again.
And you also have two immensely popular books about poetry itself, The Craft, The Life. You have A Poet's Companion, which you co-wrote with Dorianne Locks, and everybody uses that in their poetry classes. I see that book everywhere.
Yeah. A lot of students have used it, and people have used it in their college and community college classes. It's been great.
And you also have Ordinary Genius, which you wrote on your own, and which is also immensely popular. How did these books come about?
Well, as I said, I love teaching, and I'm always really interested in how to teach writing and how you learn to write and wonder, you know, well, how did I learn to write? You know, because I just really started with no background in writing, and, you know, I always read a lot as a kid, but they were fiction books, and, you know, novels, and and so when I came to poetry, I was brand new to it, and I had no idea what to do or what to read or any of that, and so I think I've always been interested, especially in people who are just coming to poetry and learning about it, learning to read it, learning to write it. And Dorianne and I were doing some teaching together in the Bay Area when she lives there. And we sort of decided that we would stop Xeroxing everything all the time and try to kind of put it together into a book, you know, put a book together of what we had been teaching on these sort of weekend classes that we would do just in the community. So that's how the Poet's Companion got started. And then 10, 15 years later, I had been teaching all that time, and I was still interested in teaching writing and how to learn to write. So I wrote Ordinary Genius, which is, I think, in a way, maybe the Poet's Companion on mushrooms. I thought of it as a more, in some way, a compliment to the Poet's Companion, but also, you know, a book for people who want to learn to write or people who are writing and need some inspiration or people who want to take their writing into performance or into collaboration with other artists, something on, you know, there are ideas in there about making broadsides and making a movie of your poem and kind of taking poetry and expanding it in other ways into the world. And Ordinary Genius has some canonical poems in it, whereas The Poet's Companion just had contemporary work. Mm. And this time I wanted to say, it's all poetry. Right. It's all part of poetry, and go ahead and read Keats's Ode on a Grecian Urn next to a Dennis Johnson poem, you know, or a Marilyn Nelson poem. And it's all poetry, and it's all of a piece. And I kind of wanted that to be the case this time also, to just invite people in. That's really what both those books are about. They're saying, come on in, it's a great party, and come and write and read, because it's an amazing world of ideas and emotion.
Who were the first poets that really inspired you and wanted to make you become a poet?
I think I was probably reading some Plath when I first sort of had that amazing feeling that you get. But I do remember reading Howell when I was 20 and being really amazed by that. I remember reading Walt Whitman and just feeling somehow so connected because he was talking to me, even though I wasn't alive yet. And I love that feeling that he was talking about the people who were going to come after him and who would read his words. And here I was, one of those people he had imagined while he couldn't possibly imagine me.
You know, I felt the same way about Whitman. Tell me, what's your relationship to Dickinson?
I love Dickinson. I love Dickinson. I came to her later. I found her so magical and so... What fascinates me is you take Whitman and Dickinson, the two biggest poets of the 19th century, right. and how incredibly different they are.
They're going in opposite directions.
And yet they're going to the same place. And I think that's really wonderful that poetry can get there in so many different ways. And the way, you know, poetry now, there's so many different ways of making a poem and so many different kinds of poetry out there. And I just think it's beautiful how many ways people are doing the same thing, which is just expressing what it means to be alive and expressing the spirit and trying to connect with other people and trying to understand the suffering in the world and what we can do about it, and is celebrating, you know, all the things that there are to celebrate. And so I just love that there's such a so many ways to do it. And Whitman and Dickinson are just, you know, you look at them and yeah, they're going in opposite directions in some ways, but in another sense, they're just side by side.
I turn to Whitman a lot, and recently, though, I've turned to Dickinson, and I just find her amazing, and something that I didn't see in her work earlier in my life, I really am now blown away by it. Maybe it took me 58 years to really understand what she's doing.
Yeah, she's not easy to understand, but she is magical, and, you know, she takes time, a different kind of time and thinking and way in, I think, than Whitman, who's so out there and so easy to sort of get hold of with all of his lists and his things of the world, and he's such a poet of the body. And Emily is such a poem of the spiritual body.
And yet you could say at once that they are both poets of desire.
Uh-huh, absolutely.
Tell me, if someone were to ask you why you wrote, it seems like such a banal question, but I think it's really an important question. Could you answer that question?
Oh, God. I mean, it is something that I have to do. It's my way of being in the world. You know, it's the way I process what happens to me. It's the way I discover what I think. It's the way I redress my wrongs and say God and open doors in my head and walk into rooms when I don't know what's in there. It's so many different things. And it's like music, you know. I play music too, and those are just my modes, you know. Language and music are the ones that come naturally to me. I have friends, you know, who paint and draw, and they can't write at all, but when they get into that medium, they are in their world. You know, I have a brother who's an athlete, and that's his medium. And I think we all sort of have those particular gifts that we're given, and if we're lucky, we find them and we develop them and we're able to really appreciate them and maybe then give something to others that they can appreciate.
We're talking to Kim Adonizio, whose latest book of poems is Lucifer at the Starlight with W.W. Norton. Did you write this book, or did you just write poems for a while and the book happened?
Well, it came together the way all my books came together, which is first that I just write for a long time, like a year or two, mm-hmm. and put things in a folder and try not to look at them and try to forget I ever wrote them, because that's the only way I can get some objectivity on them. Then I go back and I pull out ones that interest me and I work on them, and when I start to feel like I'm reaching critical mass, which is usually around 20 to 25 poems that I feel good about, then I begin to feel that I'm working on a book. And often by then I have a name, and by then I have a sense of what some of the themes are. And so then I keep writing, but I'm also sort of in the back of my head realizing that things are going to go into a book.
Mm.
And what is that book going to be about? What are its concerns going to be? And what's going to fit? And I don't really make any decisions until much later, but like now I'm just about reaching critical mass on the next book. I know what it's called. I know what some of its themes are. So I'm still just writing, and maybe another 6 months from now I'll sit down and then do the scientific thing we all do, which is spread it all over the floor and call
it around. Exactly.
And look, I don't know of a writer who doesn't do it that way.
Denise Levertov used to do it that way too.
Yeah, and you just sort of like spread them around and look at them and try to figure out what calls to what, and then they start to kind of come together in different ways.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the title itself, Lucifer at the Starlight, where that came from?
Yeah, I wrote a poem called Lucifer in Starlight, or rather, I wrote a poem called Lucifer at the Starlight as a response to a poem called Lucifer in Starlight, which is by George Herbert. And his poem is a sonnet about Lucifer coming up from hell and then being sort of beaten back down by God and the angels. And the basic message of the poem is a very religious one that, you know, good triumphs over evil. And I read that poem and I thought, well, I don't know about that. You know, I might have misspoke, too. I meant to say George Meredith, very different writer.
Yes.
Different time. But George Meredith wrote a poem called Lucifer in Starlight. And after I read that sonnet and its message of good triumphing over evil, I thought, I don't think so. So I wrote my own sonnet called Lucifer at the Starlight, Starlite, you know, as in the Starlight Lounge.
Right.
And so I imagine Lucifer coming into a bar and, you know, talking about how great things are. Now, he comes down to earth while the CEO, i.e. God, doesn't. And so I wrote this sonnet basically in response to George Meredith's sonnet. And that I knew after I wrote it was going to be the title of the collection. And so I structured the collection like a night at a bar. So the basic premise of the book is the devil walks into a bar.
Yeah.
So happy hour, the first section is events on the world stage that I thought would make Lucifer really happy because they're disaster, wars and violence and all the terrible things that are happening. So the book kind of goes on from there through. Everything is sort of put in a place where I think it belongs according to those titles.
Yeah, you have Jukebox as the next section, and then, of course, the dance floor, which is a logical next section, and then I'm going to have to take your keys.
Right, last section.
Yeah. And my favorite section is actually Jukebox, because I really like that they were, in some ways, could be construed as songs from your jukebox, which you're kind of singing to your readers. And two of my favorite poems in the collection are back-to-back in that section, and that's Another Day on Earth and Forms of Love. And they're such different poems.
Right, yeah. I conceived of that section as sort of a series of songs or stories, you know, storytelling.
We've been talking to Kim Adanizio on today's show of Words on a Wire. Kim, we always ask, we always have a poem of the week on our show. Do you have your book in front of you, Lucifer at the Starlight?
Yeah, I do.
Can you read for us Another Day on Earth?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So here's my poem, Another Day on Earth, which I wrote after the tsunami of December 26, 2004. And I should mention there's a word in here, Akashic. The Akashic record is something that is supposed to be kind of this level of reality, of ether, that where everything that happens gets recorded, every thought, every single small thing gets recorded. And so my idea was that maybe there was an angel that had that job. And that comes into this poem, Another Day on Earth. Souls were arriving, souls were departing, amid the usual screaming and crying. A lot of drinks were being tossed back. A lot of women were thinking about their hair. People were loving the quiet as snow fell, burying the cars. More than one man was thinking about his penis. Birds were landing on statues. Birds were snapping up insects. Prisoners were tending invisible flowers in their cells. A lot of televisions were feeling vaguely spiritual. A lot of shoes were hurting. A lot of hearts had fallen from the trees and were skittering along in the wind. All the oceans suddenly realized they were one ocean. Whereupon the Akashic angel, whose job it is to record each moment's folding and unfolding, paused and went on furiously writing.
That was lovely, Kim. Thanks for reading that poem for us.
And thanks for being on Words on a Wire.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
This week's poetic license comes to our listeners from our very own Blake Nemec. Blake Nemec is a third-year MFA student. He's a fiction writer and poet. His last publication was in Captive Genders, and we're very happy to have Blake with us today on our show.
Blake, he works with us here on Words on a Wire, and he's the one that actually puts all of our shows on iTunes, Blogspot, and so he's an insider. Thank you, Blake.
Thanks for inviting me into the show. So my poetic license is called How the Cypress Trees Stand on the El Paso-Ciudad Juarez Border. I lived in two different apartments in El Paso's Sunset Heights. It's in a historic district with wood, adobe, or brick buildings dating back to the Mexican Revolution. It sits on the U.S.-Mexico border. My view in the first apartment was of a brick wall. Now I look out at Ciudad Juarez. I'm rereading Roberto Bolaño's 2666 and reading for the first time Julia Estela Munares Fragrosos, Tanade una Justicia, Feminicidio Sexual Sistémico in Ciudad Juarez. In between Ciudad Juarez and my apartment complex are gray-tiled rooftops with tall brick chimneys like Pez candy dispensers. There are yucca trees and cypress trees and a couple parks where skateboards or heels clip against the sidewalk. Four of the cypress trees, the tallest ones, look like black knives pointing up towards the sun. I always think about those tree antidotes for animism when I look at those trees. You know, the ones that ask, if a tree falls in the forest, do the other trees feel it? These four reach up out of El Paso's border, almost together but not quite. There are four different heights. There are about 20 feet apart of separation between the tallest and probably 200 between the shorter ones. One of the shorter ones is skinnier than the other. They are all bending from the wind because it's November. These four trees are so tall they reach the same horizontal level as the Ciudad Juarez Mountains, a little to the right of its Liberty message written in paint. I call these trees the Four Tips. Did the Four Tips feel the Ciudad Juarez femicides from 93 to 2004? Do they know when an oriole flies into the branches of their neighbor tip and yanks out their pine? What happens to their bark skin when a squirrel bites another cypress? I mean, does it change the way they bend during a storm? Even during wicked winds, the trees don't touch. They simply stand. They simply keep growing up. In 2008, at a San Francisco healthcare clinic for sex workers, there was a labor dispute between one of the harm reduction outreach workers and the director. At first, it was about dogs. They both had pit bulls. But the outreach workers was much younger, not potty trained, and liked to run the halls. The director's was older, sat up and stared you down if it had to pee, and preferred to sleep. The outreach worker was eventually asked to leave his dog at home. Then there were budget cuts to all California city and state-funded agencies. We were funded by the Department of Public Health, so our clinic was on the chopping block. Everything changed during the budget cuts. Our hours, what kinds of services or tests we could provide, and who stayed. The outreach worker with the young pit bull was fired, and everyone raised an eyebrow of the previous conflicts the outreach worker had with the director. There were other conflicts besides the ones about the pit bull, about gender, race, and class. So some of us stood up and said the outreach worker was fired for political reasons. Then we were fired. I have wondered how to stand up for sex workers in the El Paso-Ciudad Juarez border. How can I simply stand without being cut or without cutting? The four-tipped cypress trees give me one image of how it could be done.
Thank you, Blake Nemec, for this week's Poetic License.
Well, that was a great show. Thank you for joining us. We'd like to thank Kim Atanizio for sharing her poetry and her words with us.
And we'd like to thank our very own Blake Nemec for his wise words on this week's Poetic License.
And join us next week when we're going to have another great guest and another great Poetic License at the same time.
And two great hosts.
And remember, Blake Nemec,
the next book you read
will save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a...